Looks like the Democratic Party is being torn apart before our very eyes, ladies and gentlemen. I've said it once and I'll say it again. The way we looked at politics is changing. Conservatives and liberals alike are about to have their worlds changed. Tonight, I have author of the Escaping Oz series, Jim Mascara, on the air tonight. And we're going to be talking about this very subject in his new book. So let's get started. All you have to do is stay.
For everything that is political and American, you're listening to the Garrison Douglas Show.
All right, welcome to the program, everybody. I am glad to be joined by my guest tonight. He is a principal at Sentinel Consulting and a nonfiction author who's published 3 nonfiction books in the Escaping Oz Theory series. Thank you for joining me, Jim Mascara.
Garrison, thanks for having me on tonight.
No, thank you very much for coming on. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about, so let's go ahead and get into this. The first thing I want to get into is your latest book, Escaping Oz, and Observer's Reflections. I guess the first question I have is, what all does this book entail? What all do you go into?
It really starts with a lot of fundamentals, Garrison, about what you really need in a society and what you need out of government. I wrote it in a very unique style. So for your listeners who may have not experienced a book written in this style before, you know, one of the, some feedback that I get from readers and people that I talk to is, well, you know, I don't have enough time to read, et cetera. And so I actually started recording more of my books. So they're on Audible now, including this one that we're talking about. But when I wrote this book, I thought maybe there's a way to kind of get these points across to people that maybe are pressed for time or maybe don't have the inclination to read as much as before, because obviously there's a lot of competition for our eyeballs these days. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote it in what I call short article format. So when you look at the book, it has 9 chapters, an introduction and a conclusion. So let's call it 11 particular sections. But within each chapter, there's, let's say, a number of short articles that in theory, you don't even have to read the entire book in order. You could kind of skip around. And so just imagine reading a lot of different articles, again, contained within the subject of the particular chapter that you're reading, but that you don't necessarily have to read in order. And if you just had 5 minutes to read, well, you could just read, you know, one of the articles, so to speak, within a chapter. Fundamentally, the book really addresses, again, some of the basics about what a society really needs to function, how we have drifted away significantly from those minimum requirements. And really a concept that I'm trying to introduce to a lot of audiences today is something called freedom of and freedom from. And we can certainly develop that more within the context of this conversation. But the difference between freedom of and freedom from is something that I don't think is, I mean, it's a fairly simple concept, but I don't think it's well understood because it hasn't been discussed very much. Mm-hmm. And because of, you know, we'll talk about, you know, government's role in society and so forth, we've really drifted away from freedom of, and we're really much more concerned these days with freedom from.
Okay. All right. So I guess we can try and figure out exactly how that applies to the conversation we're about to have on a bunch of different areas. For instance, like I wanted to get into the House GOP tax proposal that was released yesterday. And according to the bill, the total cost of this tax reform proposal is about $1.5 trillion, which means clearly that there's going to need to be some sort of balance with spending cuts and entitlement reform. But if you ask a lot of Democrats and even some Republicans, they're going to tell you that there's not much to cut except for defense. So I bring this up because I want to ask you this. This tax cut is designed on the premise of limited government, which I think, if you can correct me if I'm wrong, kind of goes into what you're saying of freedom of versus freedom from. But the fact that this is designed on the premise of limited government, first, do you believe we've asked government to do too much? And if so, what's the one statistic that tells us we've asked government for too much help?
Yeah, I would say quite affirmatively, we have asked government. And again, this hasn't been something that has occurred overnight. This has occurred very slowly over time. Mm-hmm. Some may argue that it accelerated, you know, in the 1960s. So let's say in the last 50 to 55 years, it's accelerated more. In my second book, it's called Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. I talk about some of the financial and monetary reasons why we have some of the problems that we have today. In specific answer to your question, have we asked the government to do too much? Yes, we have. The one statistic that unequivocally tells us that is our national debt. And when I say national debt, I'm only referring to the funded national debt, which is $20 trillion, 105% of our gross domestic product. That does not, of course, include unfunded liabilities, which when I wrote my second book, I quoted the a person who used to be the Comptroller General of the United States at the time. His name was David Walker, and he threw out a figure of about $60 trillion. Now, I've heard figures higher than that. Regardless of whether you think the figure is $60 trillion, $100 trillion, or I've even seen a figure of $200 trillion in unfunded liabilities, those are very, very large numbers to conceive, and they're numbers with a lot of zeros after them. And, you know, the United States does not have the taxing capacity or the productive capacity within the economy to come close to fulfilling all of those obligations. Now, those obligations are primarily to satisfy that freedom from part of the equation that we talked about before. Freedom of are those things that were enumerated in the Bill of Rights in our Constitution. And what we've done is politically over the course of time, and again, let's just use the last 50 to 55 years as a reference point, we've drifted more towards the freedom from. We want government to protect us from something, not we're less focused on the freedoms of that were constitutionally provided. We're asking government to ask, we're asking them to provide us more freedoms from something that might hurt us, or mm-hmm. from something that might cause us, maybe a shortcoming within our life. And because of that, and again, I'm not arguing whether that's right or wrong. I'm just telling you where we are because of that. Mm-hmm. And because of those situations and those conditions, and it's very easy to pander to the political base when you're telling, well, I can provide you a freedom from this. You know, imagine, you know, I don't think it's been too long, Garrison, since you've probably been out of college, or you may still be in college, if I mm-hmm. told you, well, Garrison, I'm going to protect you from getting an F in this class. And I'm going to, and so in order to do that, you know, you're going to give me something in return, and I'm going to provide you that protection. You know, there'd probably be a lot of college students that would sign up for something like that, you know,
I'm absolutely sure.
You know, so, you know, so you have to ask yourself the question, well, is that a role of government to try to protect me from failing a class, or is that my own responsibility? So that numerically, it's very, very easy to see that we've asked government to do way, way more than they're capable of. You know, $20 trillion debt, 105% of GDP, multiple trillions of that in unfunded liabilities. And of course, I haven't even mentioned, you know, the unfunded liabilities at the state and local level.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm glad you brought that back up. I was going to try and clarify that a little bit more. What I think a lot of people focus, like you said, most on the funded debt that we have, essentially that $20 trillion mark that we're seeing. But I don't think a lot of people pay attention to the unfunded liabilities that you were speaking of. Could you explain to my audience the difference between those two?
Yeah, so imagine, let's just use somebody's personal balance sheet as an example. Let's say that Social Security didn't exist, and let's say Medicare didn't exist at all, and that you knew that after retirement that you needed to have some money there available for you to retire at whatever age you chose to retire, and you needed to have some fund available there in case you got sick. So let's just call that even more than a rainy day fund. It's a rainy day fund plus, right? Because now you're in mm-hmm. retirement, so you're going to rely on let's call it your savings, if you will, to carry you through your golden years. Mm-hmm. Now, in order to do that, I have my current expenses that many people have, right? Somebody has a house payment, a car payment. They may have a children's college education, other expenses, you know, revolving credit card debt, so forth. You know, so that's, you're managing that process in terms of day-to-day living. So those are kind of like your current liabilities. Mm-hmm. So the unfunded liabilities would be all of that stuff that you need to put away every day, every month, whatever your time frame of reference is, in order to allow yourself to have those golden years, right? Absolutely. And so if you're not doing that on a regular basis, well, what happens when your day of reckoning arrives, which is your retirement day at age 65 or 70, whatever it is? What if that money isn't there, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's essentially what an unfunded liability is. The difference is of what's occurring right now is, of course, the government ostensibly collects that money through Social Security and Medicare, but it's not like those funds exist that are there. That's why they're called unfunded liabilities, because you know they're taxing that, they're taking that out through payroll taxes, but there's not that fund, you know, that pot of gold, if you will, that's immediately identifiable. Mm-hmm. The government just says, well, we know we owe that, so let's call it an IOU to ourselves, so to speak. And so that essentially forms the basis of unfunded liabilities. And again, that's not just at the federal level. It's also at the state level. And in many cases, it's also at the local level, where there have been, you know, covenants, entitlements that have been promised to state workers, local workers, you know, federal workers, et cetera, that there's an understanding, again, the covenant that's there for in the future, this is what's going to carry you through your golden years and through, you know, through sickness and health.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I guess I would ask this, what do you say, I'm pretty sure I already know the answer to this, but would you say then that we're not paying enough attention, or at least our government at the state and federal level is not paying enough attention to its unfunded liabilities?
Well, there's discussion about that obviously all the time, because we were talking off the air about entitlement reform, and mm-hmm. that's where the entitlement reform comes in, because the unfunded liabilities are of such magnitude that something needs to be done. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is, of course, is those decisions that need to be made and the people that are affected by it, nobody wants to feel the pain. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. You know, in this last tax proposal, there was a lot of discussion about, well, should we maintain the mortgage interest deduction? There was some discussion also, I think, is what passed about state taxes not being deductible on the federal return. And of course, mm-hmm. once it starts to turn into real money and real dollars for people, you know, there's always a pushback, right? And there may be citizenry pushback, there may be lobbying pushback, et cetera. And if you look at the tax code of the United States, Garrison, it is about the most complex labyrinth that you can potentially imagine. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I pointed out in the book is that tax code is a great lobbying tool or vehicle for organizations that want to, let's say, exert some influence on Congress or, you know, on our legislative process. Is, hey, you know what, let me, and I give some example in the book that, you know, if you were born in Montana on a Tuesday under a full moon in the month of August, you know, we have a tax deduction for you, you know. and you know, anybody that's ever done, if you've ever done your taxes, and if you don't have a professional, and if you kind of look through, you know, the IRS says, okay, to go through this just one form, it's going to take you, you know, X number of hours of preparation. And then by the time you fill it out, and then you look at some of the exclusions for different taxes or, you know, deductions at certain instances, you know, people or institutions might get, and it's a total labyrinth, you know. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I talked about in the book is, you know, if you really think about tax collection, it really shouldn't be anywhere near that comprehensively difficult. And yet it is. And that tells you that there is a great deal of legislative influence, because there are people that have people, organizations, lobbying groups that have inherited interest in passing some legislation that affects the tax code in their favor. And so the tax code essentially becomes not so much. It becomes, to me, and this is my opinion, it becomes less a revenue collection engine as opposed to an influence engine.
Okay. All right. So I guess then I would ask this then, and I want to ask you, of course, to, you know, truly side with it. But I guess one of the big goals are, you know, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan has been touting, you know, this postcard, essentially saying, you know, now with our proposal, you can do your taxes on a postcard. You just fill these boxes out and send it right in. This is what you can do. It's real small. Is that something where you believe we should be moving towards, regardless, of course, you know, the individual deductions that we're talking about, but just that specific idea, do you think that would be a better process?
I mean, in an ideal world, the simpler the tax code, the better, right? I mean, why should it be that complicated? And the reason, again, I gave you the reason. The reason it's so complicated is because you have influences, you know, over Congress about how to massage this labyrinth of a tax code mm-hmm. to create advantages for certain individuals, corporations, and so, you know, whatever it is. So any simplification would be better, but I truly do not believe that you're going to see that. Certainly not in this legislative session.
Okay. All right. So I'd like to kind of change gears here a little bit. As I said in the intro, the party structure that we've been used to, and I think, you know, just generations before have been used to, is kind of going completely out of whack. And I don't think many people know how to deal with this changing landscape. You know, I think there's a lot of conservatives in the Republican Party, or I would say more Reagan conservatives, who are trying to figure out how, you know, to where do they fit right now in the Republican Party? Where are they? And I think you have more of your maybe Clinton conservatives, Clinton liberals, who you would see in the Democratic Party, who are now being, you know, pushed out. You know, we're moving towards more of the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing of the party, the progressive. So how are you looking at this changing political landscape specifically? Like, what is your thoughts on this?
In late 2010, early 2011, when I published my first nonfiction book in the Escaping Oz series, I called it Escaping Oz, Protecting Your Wealth During the Financial Crisis. I highlighted a movement that occurred in the United States. I believe it was in the spring of 2009, and that was called the Tea Party movement. And of course, it was to mimic what occurred in the Tea Party in the late 18th century. You know, with protests over taxes. This Tea Party obviously had a slightly different complexion to it. But, you know, one of the things that I talked about was that was in my estimation, a seminal moment in American politics. And again, I understand later that there was some discussion about, you know, whether the Koch brothers funded it, whether it was truly spontaneous. To me, it really doesn't matter, you know, which, you know, whether it was totally spontaneous or the Koch brothers funded or some combination of the two. What was important to me was it was a seminal moment because it reflected a deep, deep frustration and an anger that had been building up for some time. Some people may argue that it went back all the way to 2000, perhaps even before then. I mean, I just got through watching the Vietnam series on PBS, and there were people that said that changed politics in the United States. Wherever you think the starting point of it was, that event in 2009 was very significant for me because it reflected a social mood that changed very, very markedly. Now, you would say, well, why did that occur in 2009 in the spring? Well, the reason it occurred was because what occurred the year before, which was the global financial crisis or GFC. And that event catalyzed, if you will, a lot of the rancor, I think, that was kind of building underneath. And these are manifestations that don't die out overnight. And because of that, they then acquire a political tone about them. And when I wrote that book, I said that don't be surprised if in the next decade or so that you will see, if you don't see an actual third-party candidate, you will see people rise to the top of the political sphere that do not embody any characteristic of what you're used to seeing in the Republican or Democratic Party. And that prophecy, if you will, mini prophecy on my part, I think came to fruition in 2016. And I'll lay out my thesis on that. Mm-hmm. In 2016, you had three candidates that ran for president that did not embody, and again, this is just Jim's opinion here, embodied none of the characteristics of a Democrat or Republican. I'll list them in order. The first candidate was Dr. Ben Carson. Mm-hmm. Dr. Ben Carson, if you remember, was one of the, 16 people that were standing on the stage that day in the first Republican debate. Mm-hmm. And then I think they had to break it up into two because they had so many people running.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if you, I don't know if people remember this, Ben Carson was, you know, in the very, very early polling, you know, when you had all those people together, he actually was ahead, if I remember correctly, you know. So, mm-hmm. you know, and so that told me something about, okay, you know, so the Republican base, whatever it is, however it's constituted, thought that, you know, here's a guy that, to me, again, I, whether you think he's a Republican or not, he did seem like a Republican to me, but yet mm-hmm. he was, you know, garnering a lot of support. The second person on the list is Bernard Sanders, the senator from Vermont, who, by the way, as we all know, he is actually classified as what? An independent. He's not a Democrat. And we know that he has to run as a Democrat because politics in this country, if you want to raise money, if you want to get on TV, you want to get in debates, et cetera, you have to, again, under the current rules, you need to join one of the parties. But he himself does not describe himself as a Democrat. He calls himself what? A Democratic Socialist, right? You could strongly argue, and again, the revelation today by Donna Brazil in her book about the DNC basically being pre-controlled by Hillary Clinton, and there were a lot of very disappointed Bernie Sanders fans during 2016 that felt that their candidate really had the rules, let's say, stacked against him.
So he
is candidate number two. And then the third candidate is our current president of the United States, who, I mean, I don't know how anyone could say that he's a Republican. You can't say that he's a Democrat. But he was very reflective of, again, that when I remember I mentioned that Tea Party anger before. And some people would say, well, he's representing flyover America, et cetera. Absolutely. That's exactly what he's representing. And that's part of that social mood deterioration that I alluded to way back in 2010, 2011. And so my point is that you have three candidates there that didn't embody anything that I would see in the Republican or Democratic side that, you know, I could argue that maybe if some of the shenanigans hadn't gone on with the DNC, you might have seen a 2016 election of Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump. And I don't know how that would have. I don't know the outcome of that election. And I also thought that Bernie Sanders' support would not evaporate after the 2016 election. And I read the other day in a Washington-based newspaper that Bernie Sanders is trying, there's a group that's trying to draft him for, I think it's called the People's Party or something. I may not have that exactly right. So the Bernie Sanders movement is not dead by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, on the Republican side, we had what? We had something, a movement during 2016 called Never Trump, right? There was a strong base of Republicans that didn't want to have anything to do with them, right? So now the way I look at it is on the Democratic Party side, I see somewhat of a fissure there between the let's call the progressive wing of the party with Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, maybe a Keith Ellison. On the Republican side, you have all the Republicans that do not like Donald Trump, which is maybe most of them, if not all of them. But then you have Donald Trump's base, which still seems to be very, very much intact. So it actually sets up a very, very interesting scenario for the 2020 election.
Absolutely. And I guess so. I mean, that's all just very important to know because of the fact that, you know, I have been speaking, I say for the past just couple of weeks, not for too long, but for the past couple of weeks, about kind of my observations, especially, you know, with we're seeing with Senator Bob Corker not running for re-election. We're seeing Senator Jeff Flake saying he's not running for re-election. We're seeing a bunch of House, you know, GOP House members who are saying they're not running for re-election. And to me, it just appears that, and of course, going on with Steve Bannon, his, you know, war on, you know, the Never Trumpers, but essentially really all of Congress. But to me, it seems like really that the old school conservatives, as you also called, you know, a lot of the Never Trumpers who came out, they're being hunted. You know, they're not going to be around much longer. And I guess I'm trying to figure out what the landscape of these parties are going to look like in the next, you know, by 2020, essentially. You know,
I would submit to you that those things aren't clear yet. And we were talking off the air about my fictional series where, again, I fictionalized the 2020 election. And then I threw in these alternate third parties. I personally have felt that it would probably serve the United States well to have what I call viable third parties. And by viable third parties, I don't mean parties that run in every election for president, that they garner very little vote, you know, and I don't mean like Ross Perot in 1992, where he got 19% of the vote, but how many electoral college votes did he get? He got zero, right? I'm talking about a viable political party that could actually win electoral votes, that you could see this particular party win, you know, state house races, that could win congressional races, to get some other voices in there. Because my personal belief, and we were talking earlier about the tax plan and the budget and so forth, I believe that none of this is going to get resolved absent some calamity, which will be probably financial in nature. It could be a sovereign debt crisis, because I just don't see anything getting resolved. And typically when financial calamities occur, and the next one will be of greater severity than what we felt in 2008, a lot of times that's when you see political movements kind of rise to the fore. And we don't know exactly how the economy will behave between now and the 2020 election. Although statistically, the chances of a recession and then probably an accompanying financial crisis with it is greatly, greatly enhanced, you know, compared to where we've been recently. And again, those are the conditions that then lift societies towards, you know, asking for, you know, for saviors or for salvations. And that's when you'll see candidates that will appear that say, hey, you know what, this isn't working. And I have no doubt that when these things occur, you will see an attack on what I'll consider just base capitalism. And unfortunately, what we've been living under the last, I don't know, I'll say since certainly the 1971 with the gold standard change, this is not capitalism. This is something else. And my fear is that the financial calamities will be blamed on capitalism. So there'll be a turn hard, you know, potentially towards more, let's say more authoritarian control, perhaps even over the economy. And that authoritarian control, by the way, could come from either side, left, you know, what you consider the left or right. And one of the things I talk about in my book is that we really don't have a good projection, if you will, of the political spectrum. We see everything in this kind of left, right, Republican, Democrat spectrum. But the reality is the political spectrum is much, much wider than that. On the one side, you have what would be total anarchy, which would be no one's in charge. And on the other side, you have what I'll call the isms, the communisms, the fascisms, and the socialisms. When we started this great nation over 200 years ago, 250 years ago or so, we were actually closer towards the side of greater liberty, so that first side that I mentioned. But over the course of time, again, we've drifted more politically towards the isms, okay? Yeah. And that gets back to the thesis that I mentioned where, again, we're asking government to do more, the freedom of and the freedom from.
Okay. So given that, and talk with the multi-party or, you know, a viable third party, I think the last time, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong here, I believe the last time we saw a viable third party candidate who actually had electoral votes would have been Teddy Roosevelt during that, you know, fracture of the Republican Party. Do you project that sort of that you would see that fracture happening among Republicans more than likely this time around if we saw a viable third party, or would it be what you were speaking about earlier with like a Bernie Sanders and the People's Movement? Would it be more on the left?
Or, you know, I if I gave you an answer right now, I feel that, and again, everything I've talked about so far, I've tried to be very as apolitical as possible. All my writing, I think I have an inherent bias here in this answer because I would like to see third party political representation, and the reason I say that is because I don't see any change occurring until you have, you know, a crisis that occurs. And again, a bigger crisis than we suffered in 2008. And so, you know, so I'm going to say, yeah, you know what, I could see a third political party splitting from the Democrats and the Republicans, you know, and so maybe in 2020 you actually have, you know, the GOP and the Democrats, as we're always used to seeing, and then a couple of other parties that are running that, you know, maybe they take life from that point forward. And again, by the way, just for your listeners, I mean, this idea of these third political parties having an active role in government and in our federal government, that's not really that an outlandish an idea, because if you look at, you know, if you look towards the European continent, most of those countries don't just have two parties. There's multiple parties that participate and they have to form coalition governments and so forth. And you know, and there's nothing that, you know, constitutionally prevents multiple parties from running. You know, we used to have more parties than that in the United States, you know, certainly in the 19th century. So, again, it wouldn't surprise me if you had at least one political party, where it would split off from. I really don't know. But my sense is that there's enough rancor in the population right now that, especially combine all this with a financial event or a sovereign crisis of some sort, and it'll be much, much easier for a third political party to take wings and fly.
Okay. Yeah. And I think I really wonder if we're I guess with the whole thing we're seeing what now with the Donald Brazil revelation, I think it gave weight to me that we're probably that we might see more coming from the more millennials, essentially, of the Democratic Party feeling betrayed. The people who are supporting Bernie saying, you know, hey, I can't deal with the DNC anymore. I can't deal with the Democratic Party. You know, they're corrupt. They're this and that. And, you know, we might see the same thing, of course, with Republicans later on. But definitely, I believe my personal opinion on that would have been that we're probably definitely going to see some sort of allusion towards that. Towards the Democrats essentially making that break off. But I do want to quickly shift gears here towards essentially America's foreign policy, essentially how we're perceived on the world stage. As you know, the president just left today, actually, to begin his 12-day trip through Asia. And with everything going on with North Korea and you know, the South China Sea, how China responds to the president's visits, to me at least, is going to be very important. And traditionally, America has been perceived as an empire who has no limits to its reach and wields enough influence and power to get pretty much everything it wants internationally. Do you believe that still applies today? And if not, how do you think this will affect the president's meetings in Asia?
It does still apply today to the extent that the United States obviously wields a very, very large hammer. You know, obviously, the United States has the ability to project naval power unlike any other nation on Earth. Mm-hmm. The problem that you're running into is the trend in the world today, and certainly the United States, is towards more, let's say, separation, if you will. You know, you're seeing some of these movements in Spain, as an example. You know, Britain with Scotland, where there's a kind of whereas before, you know, certainly World War I, World War II tended to collect territories that, you know, maybe weren't associated with one another, and then were essentially what brought together, and they were melded together in some sort of a post-war treaty. The Soviet Union was a great example of that, right? I mean, the Soviet Union right now is what was it called? It was Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Well, now those republics have broken off now, and you have Russia, you know, Ukraine is a separate country, the Baltic region is, three separate countries. So there's more of this let's say more of a disarray, if you will. The cohesiveness that existed before is kind of breaking up just internationally as it is. The United States, of course, was part of, you know, that arrangement to keep some of these territories together and cobbling together countries. You know, Iraq is a really, really good example, you know, of things that were kind of cobbled together into a country. And now you see splits with the Kurds in the north. What happens with an empire? Empires cost a lot of money, right? I mean, mm-hmm. You can't have a navy projecting that power. You know, we have military stationed, I thought I saw a statistic, in, you know, 100 countries. Mm-hmm. You know, we found out not long ago that we lost 3 servicemen in Niger, you know, in the middle of Africa, which I had no idea that we had, you know, any troops there. And then we found out that they're building an airbase there for drone warfare. Mm-hmm. Those things cost a lot of money. And we talked earlier about, you know, how we've asked the government to do so much. Well, part of that is in this in the footprint of the empire, not like the British Empire, where they were actually colonizing, because, you know, we're not colonizing anybody. But the empire is the military influence that you see. And that big stick that the United States wield, that they can wield politically as well, with sanctions against countries. Well, you know, countries are starting to catch on to that. And they're deciding, you know what, how can we kind of fall out of the orb of the United States of political power? Well, all countries of the world to exercise international trade, because of the Treaty of Bretton Woods in 1945, they needed to have dollars in order to conduct their international transactions. Well, guess what a lot of countries are doing now? You know, they're getting away from that. You know, they're saying, hey, you know what, China and Russia, when we trade, rather than convert everything to dollars, let's just exchange our own currencies. Obviously, for those that are more technically savvy, the developments with distributed ledger transactions right now with cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum, that's going to be another avenue to basically disintermediate the dollar. Mm-hmm. So very, very careful, you know, how the United States projects its military policy and geopolitical policies, because countries at some point, they don't want to have to deal with that anymore. And as an example, if you see what's going on with North Korea right now, and the leader of North Korea is portrayed to be this, you know, psychopathic leader, which, again, he's never going to win any Boy Scout awards for sure. But, you know, if you put yourself in his position, what has he seen internationally? He's seen an invasion of Iraq, which took out a leader, Saddam Hussein. He's seen an invasion of Libya, which took out Muammar Gaddafi. He's seen an attempted invasion, if you will, of Syria. And in my country where I'm from, I'm originally from Panama. The United States got tired of dealing with a general there, Manuel Noriega. And so what happened in 1989? They sent the U.S. Army essentially, you know, to get one person, you know.
Yeah.
so if you look at it from a foreign political leader's point of view, what card can that foreign political leader play to kind of circumvent, you know, the empire wield of the United States? Well, one is, you know, potentially economic, right? To get away from the dollar, maybe get away from the, you know, international banking system. But the other way is to have some military card that they can play that would make the United States think twice about conducting an invasion or something to get them out of power. In North Korea's case, you know, they've chosen the nuclear option. So, if you look at it from that perspective, it's a very rational response on their part to try to potentially forestall what they see as a threat, you know, to being deposed. And again, no one's going to award, you know, again, gold medals or humanitarian, you know, medals or Boy Scout awards to any of these leaders for sure. But again, if you look at it from their perspective, you can see how and why some of these countries. Iran's another one, by the way. I didn't mention that. You know, they've been on the fringe there. Well, you know, they're trying. You know, they were trying to create a nuclear weapon again for some of the same reasons. So I just think Americans need to think about that, and they also need to think about, you know, what some of the roots of some of the international terror are, and the United States empire footprint has a lot to do with it.
Okay, and so I think you had said that a lot of countries are trying to now look at, you know, how to get out of our orb, essentially our political orb. And that's kind of, is that destabilizing to our empirical presence? I guess I would ask.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that people within, you know, what you would call the deep state, you know, the military industrial complex. I mean, obviously they're not going to look very favorably on that. Mm-hmm. You know, the military industrial complex is a very profitable complex, you know, and that's something that General President Eisenhower warned about, you know, 60 plus years ago on his way out of office. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it might be destabilizing from their point. But, you know, the United States foreign policy has created a lot of instability in foreign countries. You know, Iraq's probably, to me, the seminal case of that, where, you know, the destabilization of Iraq created these elements that you see that have morphed into, you know, these international terror organizations that, albeit they were, you know, kept under the thumb of Saddam Hussein and his, you know, autocratic rule. But if you think about it, we didn't have those same international terror organizations and threats during Saddam Hussein's rule. All that came afterwards. So my point is that, you know, whenever we put our footprint somewhere hypothetical, non-hypothetical U.S. empire, we need to think about what the consequences are going to be, you know, to the local citizenry there, and what may happen politically once we destabilize a region, particularly if that region wasn't really a country before, but something that might have been cobbled together post-World War I or World War II.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Jim. This has just been very informative. I know for certain my audience is going to agree with that assessment. But I think that's all the time we actually have for today. Everyone, if you love what you heard today, which I'm sure you did, I know I did, make sure look at Jim's new book, Jim Mascara, Escaping Oz, an Observer's Reflection. Observer's Reflections. It's on Amazon.com. You can get it. You can also visit his website, JimMascara.com. I'm going to have the link on the website as well as the Facebook page. That way you can have a direct link to his website and to the book. But thank you very much, Jim, for coming on. Hopefully we can definitely have you on the program again sometime.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Good being on the show with you tonight.
Thank you very much. All right. But that's all the time we have for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. This is Friday. So, of course, we are going to be back on Monday. So I look forward to seeing everyone back there. In the meantime, everyone have a safe and blessed weekend. Good night.